We're going to bring the meeting to order. We have a lot of members missing. There was a joint transportation hearing at the Capitol with the House and the Senate, so I'm assuming that some of them are still there. But we may as well get started on our presentation. So would you let us know who you are and what you're doing here?
Madam Chair, my name is David Kelleher. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Historical Society.
I'm Bill Keith. I'm the head of the Historic Sites and Museum Division for the Minnesota Historical Society.
And my name is Rita Bloomberg, and I'm the Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer at the Minnesota Historical Society.
Welcome to the committee. You may proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to make a presentation to the committee on historic preservation and asset preservation. We thought that it would be helpful to the committee to, as you are doing your work this year, as you plan on doing your field trips through the summer and fall, and then as you do your work next year during the session to assemble a capital budget bill, it would be helpful to have some background on historic preservation in Minnesota, some of the terminology that we use, some of the issues that are specific to state-owned historic structures, and then we'll spend a little bit more time discussing buildings that are in the State Historic Sites Network that the Minnesota Historical Society operates for the public's enjoyment. And specifically on that front, asset preservation needs that we request from the governor and the legislature to keep those buildings together. I guess, first of all, it would be helpful to ask the question, historic preservation, why does it matter? Why is this important? As you look at an image of the Sibley House in Mendota, a real simplistic answer to that question would be, in certain cases, it's the law. And two areas of Minnesota law that deal with this are the Minnesota Historic Sites Act, which talks about the responsibilities of state agencies and local governments to preserve historic structures, and that in a broader sense, the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act discusses historic sites and the responsibility to preserve historic sites and historic structures under that part of the law. But in addition to the simplistic legal requirements, there are some additional benefits for our state as a whole. Community pride and identity, and educational benefits, as we see visitors enjoying costume characters and enjoying Split Rock Lighthouse up on the north shore of Lake Superior. In addition, historic preservation for a number of communities across the state provides economic benefits. Think of communities such as Red Wing, Duluth, where people go to enjoy a sense of place, explore their past, and the built environment really contributes to that reason for people to go to those communities.
There are a lot of terms that are thrown around when we talk about historic properties and historic preservation as a field, and one of them is the National Register of Historic Places. We have a number of copies of our checklist. This is a listing of all the properties in the state of Minnesota that are listed on the National Register. This is the nation's official listing of properties that have been deemed worthy of preservation. And it is really the benchmark that we use in understanding the significance of historic resources. The National Register embraces a wide variety of properties, those that are locally significant, those that are significant at the statewide level, as well as those that might be nationally significant. And it embraces not only historic properties, but also or historic buildings, but also all varieties of historic properties, everything from bridges to historic districts to shipwrecks on the bottom of Lake Superior to you name it. It's a category of resource that can be eligible for listing on the National Register. Kind of the top of the list are the National Historic Landmarks. These are a very few in number. Minnesota has 22 National Historic Landmarks. These are considered those that have the greatest significance to the nation as a whole. 22 of those, the one that was most recently listed as a national landmark is the Rabidoux CCC camp. The State Historic Preservation Office, in which I work, is the office that is charged with the responsibility of really safeguarding our state historic resources. We partner with federal agencies as well as local governments and private citizens all across the state to help people ensure that historic properties are preserved for future generations. One of our chief responsibilities is issuing a statewide plan for historic properties or historic preservation that is in your packet of materials. The standards that we follow in working to rehabilitate and restore historic properties are standards that have now been in place for almost 40 years, the Secretary of the Interior standards. These are standards that are, again, both flexible and broad. There are standards for restoration projects. When you're in situations with a National Historic Landmark, it might be a museum, you're looking at restoration standards. When you're working with a business owner on Main Street, you're working with rehabilitation standards, standards that allow flexibility. But it's these are, again, kind of benchmarks on standards that are interpreted and used to guide our work. Many of you have probably heard the term the Section 106 review. This is a review that is authorized under the National Historic Preservation Act, and it gives the state of Minnesota really a voice in federal projects that are happening in the state. It allows us to work with federal agencies to ensure that historic properties are taken into consideration when federal projects are undertaken, whether it's a large highway project, for instance, or even a small licensing or permitting project by the Corps of Engineers. So with all of these historic properties, who is responsible? The vast majority of properties in the state of Minnesota that are on the register are actually in private ownership. The vast majority, there are, of the properties listed on the register, there are some 1,500 listings, over 6,500 individual properties. The vast majority are in private hands. They continue to serve as homes and businesses for private citizens. And many of them, another category of private ownership would be the nonprofits. And our office, again, works with many nonprofit organizations that own and manage historic properties. Pictured here is the Pickwick Mill, which is down in Winona County. It's owned by a nonprofit historical organization, and it's one that has actually received some state grants and aid through the Minnesota Historical Society that have been authorized by the legislature in years past. And, of course, the state of Minnesota is a major owner of historic properties. We have a report that we have only a couple copies of that we can certainly circulate, but the state of Minnesota owns a great many historic properties. You'll hear a little later from our Historic Sites Division about those that are interpreted historic sites. But again, here we sit, you know, in the state office building, across the road, the Minnesota State Capitol. Many functions of the state continue to be carried out in historic properties that are of a great deal of value to the state as a whole. And one of the patterns we've seen in recent years is the state has been divesting itself of some of those campuses. You know, recently the Wilmer State campus was sold from state ownership. When that occurs, changes happen, and it is incumbent upon the State Historic Preservation Office to work with the Department of Administration to ensure that there are some protections in place that can continue to provide ways that these historic properties can serve in a new use.
A quick mention of the booklet, the white booklet that's going around. This is about 20 years old. It's in need of updating, but it's a very good guide to buildings in 1986 that were in state ownership. And there's quite a range from correctional institutions to higher educational institutions, armories, and many others. So I've mentioned that it's dated because it is 20 years old and needs to be updated, but it's a good guidebook for your reference.
And the information on the properties themselves is actually really helpful. Yes?
No, I just announced your name for the tape.
The largest category of state-owned properties that are not mentioned in detail in that book are actually those that are in the state parks. And in the late 80s, we did a survey of state parks and looking specifically at those properties built under the federal relief construction programs of the 1930s. And there are close to 400 properties in Minnesota state parks that are now listed on the National Register located in our state park.
The next large group of historic structures that are owned by the state or arms of the state are higher ed institutions. And you see in the slides the Armory and Pillsbury Hall on the U of M campus, both of which have been nicely preserved by the university. And a further category of historic structures that are owned by public entities are local governments. City halls, county courthouses are many of those across the state. There's a picture here of the Litchfield Opera House, which most recently has served as the City Hall in Litchfield and is the subject of a debate within that community over the future of that building. But local governments have been good stewards in many cases of their historic structures. Another example is the Minneapolis Armory that is now owned by Hennepin County. They're working to find a reuse. They've been working on that for a number of years, but it's an important historic structure that warrants preservation. And again, Brita mentioned some of the state facilities that are historic structures owned by the state, including the Minnesota Historical Society. The Department of Administration, specifically the Real Estate Management Division, has oversight over a number of those buildings, but the individual agencies come forward to you to seek funding through their asset preservation requests and specific major appropriations to keep those sites in good shape. In addition, we have provided grant funds through appropriations made by this committee for local governments to preserve their individual historic properties. As you may expect, there are a number of challenges with preserving and reusing historic structures, not the least of which is the costs. I think you have heard many times and will continue to hear the challenges that costs that are borne by agencies in preserving structures. Staffing, the needs to keep up the daily maintenance needs for historic structures is a challenge. And as Brita mentioned earlier, finding a new use for a campus for which the use is obsolete is another major challenge. Pictured here is the Fergus Falls Regional Treatment Center, something like 1 million square feet. Just an excellent example of the architecture of that day, but it's a big challenge for the state to figure out a reuse for that. Agencies certainly have their own priorities. The Department of Corrections is mandated by you to provide beds for prisoners, and they have to weigh that against the costs of providing historic preservation. I think another need is for us to have a good snapshot of what's out there. We have a good sense of what's in our historic sites network. We've had conversations with the Department of Administration and other agencies, but getting a good handle through the state's facilities condition audit program to see what's out there and over the long term what the needs are is a challenge. All is not grim, however. We have many opportunities in the coming years. We've heard a lot of discussion about green buildings and the possibilities that we have with green buildings and green construction methods. But it's important to remember that historic buildings are green buildings. They are reusing the energy that's been put into the lumber and the bricks and the other building materials. That energy that has gone into those structures can be reused and not wasted by having it go into a landfill. So I think it's important to think of those features when you're considering costs overall.
I think you have to look at the overall picture of the cost as well. Historic buildings that were constructed a century ago have lasted over 100 years. And many of the new buildings that are going up today that we see springing up across the landscape will never last 100 years. When you look at kind of the cost of all of the materials that have gone into that and over time, that finding ways to rehabilitate and finding new uses for these buildings that have lasted a long time and are still very sound structurally is, I think, really worth our effort. And we find increasingly that doing restoration and rehabilitation work is very sustainable and very can be very effective in many ways. The other thing is that in recent times, the technologies have really advanced. 25 years ago, it was very much more challenging to find the kinds of manufacturers, for instance, that could make the windows for historic properties that needed to have replacement windows. That's no longer the case. We now have a number of sources for simple things that really stymied our efforts years ago. So that is something that is changing. The other thing is that our office, the State Historic Preservation Office, is really here to help. And we have a historical architect on staff who is available to consult with private citizens as well as agencies and others, local governments, in finding ways to really find preservation solutions that can allow us to continue to use our historic resources in ways that are productive and effective. And so we really want to be available to be helpful in finding preservation solutions.
And Madam Chair, as you conduct your tours this summer and fall, and as you tour campuses where historic buildings are present, if any questions come up, please do ask us. There are a number of what I would describe as urban legends that come up on some of the tours that we hear second and third hand reports of. The Historical Society made us do something, and when I try to track them down, it's not the case, and it's a misunderstanding. So we'd be happy to work with you as you're working on your tours to educate everyone involved about the historic structures that are out there. And Madam Chair, with that, Bill Keyes is going to start on the section relating to the Historic Sites Network.
Mr. Keyes.
Thank you. I wanted to talk about the Historic Sites Network. You can see this map of the state of Minnesota, and for each of those dots, it represents one of the 30 historic sites that the Minnesota Historical Society holds in trust for the people of Minnesota. And these range widely across the state. They also range widely in terms of scale of the individual sites and the kind of properties they are. Some of them are trails. Some of them have large interpretive centers. Some of them are historic houses. We're responsible for them all. And I think that these really represent the most important historic sites in the state. This network was assembled back in the 1960s, and since then, the Minnesota Historical Society has been presenting the story of Minnesota history through these sites as the places where our history happened. We've also really have a high responsibility for preserving these properties, and that can be quite a challenge. But we do provide statewide service through these sites. I'm going to show you some images of some projects we've been working on of late, and to try to give you a sense of the variety of things that are out there and the variety of challenges that they pose. The top image here is of the Comstock House in Moorhead. This house has been, is currently, there are projects out to bid to keep this house going. Below it is the Kelly Farm, the barn at the Kelly Farm near Anoka. The Kelly Farm is really an extraordinary example of the way that the Historical Society has brought history alive for the people of Minnesota and kept a very important part of the story, the agricultural story, alive for the people of Minnesota. You can go ahead. You can also see that what we're talking about here in terms of some sense of number left-hand side of the screen, you can see the number 140 buildings and structures. And many of those are over 100 years old. And they represent a whole variety of building techniques and of building styles, and we want to make sure that we preserve those well. You can see the Sibley House, which is in Mendota, and also the boyhood home of Charles Lindbergh near Little Falls. This is the Ramsey House here in St. Paul. We've recently done some, you'll see later on some images of some of the work that was done on that site. And that house, like you could say the Kelly Farm as well, and a number of Lindbergh House certainly, these structures were never intended really to be for public visitation. So you can imagine the thousands and thousands of people that have marched through Charles Lindbergh's house. In the entire time that the family lived there, there might have been, I don't know, 30 or 40 or 50 people who marched through there. We get that many in an hour and a half. And so the traffic has a great effect on that house and all the other properties that we have. And so we're constantly having to maintain just because of that level of use, which is precisely why we're preserving them, so the public does get to see them. The two images you see here, the upper one is of the visitor center at Mille Lacs Indian Museum. And quite a number of these sites now have visitor centers that very often have an exhibition gallery inside of them with an exhibit that interprets the activities on the site. They also have, some of them have food service, they have restrooms, ticketing, those kinds of visitor amenities that are really essential and has come to be an expectation of our visiting public. Below that you can see an image, an older image of the Indian Trading Post, which we continue to operate. And it has a really incredible array of Indian-related items from all over the country. And we get a lot of people who come to that site specifically to buy at that materials there. The challenge that's come now is a different one than we've faced in the past. We're almost always looking at historic structures in the past. But now we're starting to look at newer buildings. Some of the visitor centers that we've built are now 30, 40 years old. Mechanical systems in them are starting to fail. Roofs are starting to fail. And so now we're looking at doing essentially repair work where on sites we had largely done preservation work in the past. And so we've started out with just doing inventories of all the roofs of the 140 buildings we're responsible for. We're now starting to look at all the HVAC systems and finding a lot of those will need help too. Security systems in all these buildings. And there's, you know, system after system in these 30 and 40-year-old buildings are now demanding more time, energy, and, of course, they're demanding more money. In some ways, we're seeing kind of a shift, whereas over the past several decades, we were coming to the state looking for help in building visitor centers or upgrading visitor centers. Now we're going to be looking more and more at the issues of maintaining those systems in those buildings. And I think that they're worthwhile because they're really where the education occurs on these sites. These visitor centers really bring these the story of the individual sites to the public in a very close and engaging way. One last aspect of this that I wanted to mention was also of staffing for carrying on a project like these. These are not, for the most part, just ordinary construction projects. They require people with a specific kind of training expertise. They have to navigate between a very complicated regulatory system. They also have to do things using a state system that was geared very often to very large construction projects. These complications make for a slow process, too. Also, there are only a limited number of architects who have the experience and qualifications to deal with preservation projects. So we often find that we're going back very often to the same firms, and there's a kind of flow in the pipeline that we're always dealing with. These tend to have a longer timeline than new construction as well, and the technology for them is always changing. So I mentioned already that we are doing a survey of needs constantly. We're always looking at what is out ahead of us, and for each bonding session, we're always making a list of what are the projects that are in most greatest need, and those rise to the top. And they are spread around the state, and we're always looking at the greatest need here. With each of these, there is design work that has to be done. We don't, we can't, because of the complicated nature of these projects, we're always using engineers and architects design work. And so there's a bidding process that goes through that, and then into a whole design process, and then a bidding for construction. Finding qualified contractors is always a complicated issue as well. All these things tend to make them much more costly projects than a normal run-of-the-mill, either repair work or new construction. But we think that the investment is really worth it. Yes, please.
Could you tell me if, when you go to find a qualified contractor, do you use state workers or do you hire out outsourced workers, or are these people that we don't have the experience in the state to handle some of these?
You could say that there's a scale of these things. On the very local level, at the individual site, some of the larger sites have employees who are doing day-to-day maintenance on things. They might fix a door, they might paint a windowsill. But the higher up you get into the complication and scale of these projects, we do not have the staff to do them. And the process involves us putting these things out to bid. So we are bidding out this work on a competitive basis. Increasingly, we're trying to, because we're spread all over the state as well, we also try to bid those projects locally so that the these capital dollars actually go into the hands of the local communities rather than all staying here in the Twin Cities. We make sure that that's happening as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You may proceed.
You heard mention earlier on of the Secretary of Interior standards, and those are really the guideposts by which we judge our work. And we have a unique circumstance in the fact that we are also, within the Historical Society, the regulator for adherence to the Secretary of Interior standards. So you could say that we have a higher level of responsibility than perhaps other people who are doing this kind of work. We have to set an example, is one way of saying it. And that really has a price tag too, but we feel that that is worth it. This is the right work for us to be doing, and we want to set the best example for this kind of work. We also provide technical expertise for people who are doing projects as well. I want to give you a couple of examples of some projects recent. Do you want to show that thing around? We last year finished a project at the James J. Hill House, which is practically within sight of this building. And the reason why it's within sight is it's so large, for one thing. That house has an extraordinary roof system that was devised more than 100 years ago at a time when the owner of the house had a railroad. And that railroad could deliver all the coal he wanted. And that coal could heat up a boiler, which heated up water and ran in pipes up into the eaves of the roof, and so that the roof was kept frost-free. Well, we no longer run that system. We no longer have a train that delivers coal to our door. So we had to find other ways of dealing with ice dams and problems we've had over the years. That bottom image you can see is the steps of rebuilding the whole roof system of the Hill House. And you can see that there's an angle iron there, which are the supporting system for the slates.
Madam Chair, we have some show and tell here. As you can see, the angles that Mr. Keyes described up on the picture, when they were new, they would have looked like this. This is an example of the pieces that were replaced. What they took out from the roof system was this. So the deterioration had gone to this level, and we can pass this around so you can see exactly what happens with a 110-year-old roof that's been through the heat and thaw cycle through that time. The other parts of this project had to do with changing the system of what they call a hot roof and a cold roof. And essentially, a cold roof system is where the insulation is at the floor of the attic, and you allow it to be cold. So you want the same temperature on both sides of the roof. And we were switching that to a system where we were insulating against the inside of that. But, of course, this is a historic structure of incredible importance, and so the methodology had to be devised uniquely for this building to establish a whole insulation system inside of the attic. The other part was that it's not just a matter of slate. You can see in the image there that green line across the bottom here. That is the copper gutters. And there's also underneath that custom-made pieces of a copper soffit underneath the eaves. Each of those pieces has a decorative element to it. There were also copper brackets. Some of you who were in this committee a number of years ago may recall us bringing in one of those corroded scroll brackets that were about this big and custom-made, essentially, for this purpose. So replacing all of that material was an extraordinary task. And lastly, there was also a copper and glass skylight over the gallery in the house, and that had to be completely rebuilt. Another example here is one from historic Forestville at the Meehan store down near Preston. And this has been really a lot of bits and pieces on this project over a number of years. What you see here right now is really trying to
do some insulation on the back of the house. It's kind of hard to tell what this image is, but this is a project. You can see, you know, that that's Split Rock Lighthouse, I'm sure. The image that's on the left, though, is actually inside the light. And that checker plate there, you can see the puddles of water that are there. There's water getting around the glass and the metal frames around the light up in there, and it has to be pretty much taken apart and put back together again. But this is going to be a pretty monumental task. This is the Harkins store. There was a great deal of work that went on there. I mentioned earlier on about the Ramsey House. On the left here is an image of one of the columns that was holding up the porch. Actually, it wasn't the column that was holding up the porch. It was the paint that was holding up the column that was holding up the porch. Because inside of it, the termites had pretty much devoured the column itself. Carpenter ants, rather.
That's better.
Oh, there's, and this is the Lindbergh Visitor Center up in Little Falls, where some rehabilitation work was done onto the existing visitor center, and an exhibition was added. I wanted to give you a brief update on the status of the 2005 and 2006 appropriation projects. So you saw the Hill House roof, which is now complete. That was really quite an undertaking, and I think it really turned out beautifully, and they did a terrific job on it. And there's work right now. If you drive on Highway 5 from St. Paul towards the airport, off to your left, you'll see the walls of historic Fort Snelling, and over the roofs of many of those buildings, you'll see plastic about the color of the blue of this slide. That's because we're replacing roofs out there. Those roofs, for the most part, were about 30 years old, and they're split shakes, and that's pretty much the life of those is maybe 20 years, and so we're replacing almost all the roofs out there. That work is well underway. Other work that's occurred out there is the Half Moon Battery, which is the behind the Commandant's house, a semicircular stone battery. Part of the deck on that caved in last year due to rotting timbers, and when it did that, it did damage to the stonework, and that is being rebuilt. And the same thing with the Round Tower, which is probably really the emblem of Fort Snelling, visible from the highway, and that work is being done now as well. Other 2005 and 6 appropriation projects are ones. You saw an image of the Comstock house earlier on. We've selected the architect. We're going to be heading into construction this year. Split Rock, the architect's been selected. The construction there will be in 08. Folsom House, architect selected, construction in 07. And you can see down through the list that really on that statewide roofing project, about 70% of it is underway.
Madam Chair, the next couple of slides provide a preview of some of the things that you'll be seeing, hopefully on some of your tours and then in the next legislative session. We are finalizing our list for a submittal to the Department of Finance and the Governor's Office in June and July of this year. However, we have heard that there's a possibility of some one-time money going into capital budget projects, and if that does happen, we have this list for your consideration of things that you'll see later, but if dollars are available, they will need to be done at some point, and we have a list for you. And these are some of the sites that we've talked about earlier, the Mille Lacs Museum, Split Rock Lighthouse, HVAC systems around the system, the Hill House needs further work, the Capitol building itself had furnishings that were designed or selected by Cass Gilbert. Many of those are in use right now. Many of those are in need of repair, and those are general fund eligible, not bond eligible, but that would be a list that could be taken care of. There's more work to be done at Mill City Museum, Fort Snelling, the Hill House, History Center, monuments and markers around the state, and Jeffers Petroglyphs. And we'd be happy to go into whatever level of detail on any of those projects that you would like.
We have a question from Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kelleher, on your previous slide there, the Mille Lacs house. Oh, there. No, okay. The septic system there, $600,000. What's the status of that? Is it any kind of environmental problem at this point?
Mr. Keyes.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Tinglestad, the I'm searching for the short version. The short version is that within, I think, about 2 years, we've been told that within 2 years that septic system will no longer be permitted. We will no longer be permitted to use it. And so we really want to make sure that it's properly dealt with right now. Tom, is there anything you wanted to add to that? Madam Chair, may I ask Tom Fonin still, who was working on these projects, if he would like to add to that?
Yes, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Tom Fonensteel. I'm the Historic Properties Manager for the Historic Sites Division at the Historical Society. Again, as Mr. Keyes mentioned, I'll try to keep this as a short answer, but there are two buildings on the site in particular that had previously been hooked up to their own septic system, which needed replacement. And so in replacing that, we worked with the Mille Lacs County government and the band, the Mille Lacs band up there, and kind of worked through the system and what we had to do to replace that. And essentially they were grandfathering us in to put in one septic system for two buildings. But as Mr. Keyes mentioned, what we also had to do is agree with Mille Lacs County to eventually tie into the band's sanitary system that runs around the property. And they gave us a time frame of about 2 years for us to hook into that. So essentially what that will do is to take all buildings on the site and move it into the sanitary system that the Mille Lacs band has created. It's going to be quite a process because of the archaeological sensitivity of the site that we have to consider, and also working with mechanical engineers and civil engineers to figure out where exactly we could put that system and hook it up.
Thank you.
Mr. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I was a little late. I had a committee hearing. I know that I already missed the highlight slide, but that was the Litchfield Opera House, in case you missed that. But and you may have said this earlier, but now all of these projects that you've listed are they owned by the Historical Society of the State of Minnesota?
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, the list that you're looking at right now are historic sites that are in the Historic Sites Network, and actually that's a good segue to the last slide, which talks about grant programs. And we operate two major grant programs, one that's funded from the General Fund for county and local historical societies. Those tend to be smaller grants. Sometimes they're used for building needs, but most typically they're used for program items, buying a microfilm machine, that kind of thing. The second major grant program that we operate is the County and Local Historic Preservation Grant Program that's funded by bond funds, and therefore the eligible entities are public entities, cities and counties who will often use those grants for preservation of a courthouse or a city hall. The gap comes in where there's a county or local historical organization that wants to do either a building restoration or a new building, new construction project, and they're not eligible because they're a nonprofit 501c3. They're not eligible for bond funds, but there generally has not been enough general fund money through the other grant programs to go around. So that's a gap. Again, if there's an opportunity to provide one-time funding through a grant program for those kinds of needs, we'd be interested in helping some of those organizations out.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other question. Being a historian myself, I have interest in Fort Ridgely. Is there any your long-term goal to restore any of the buildings at Fort Ridgely?
We have...
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, we have over the years done work at Fort Ridgely. Probably, I think the most recent project that just was completed there had to do with an interpretive trail. I don't know of any projects on the near horizon that would expand work at Fort Ridgely, though.
Okay, you may proceed.
Madam Chair, that's the end of our formal presentation, and we would be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee members may have.
Yes, Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. couple of questions. Pertaining to your last slide here, what's available for cities? I have a city. I'll be parochial. I have a city that is looking at establishing a museum and or information site, new construction to display, obviously, historic artifacts and items. Is there programs available for those types of entities?
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, the short answer is no for new construction. The second bullet on the slide behind me, the County and Local Historic Preservation Grant Program, because those funds have been limited, we have had as a highest priority restoration of historic buildings rather than new construction of museums. But those are the parameters given the level of funding that we've had. So if someone wanted to do new construction for a county or city museum, we would have to find a different source of funds, regardless of ownership, whether it's city-owned or owned by a nonprofit.
And that's so, Madam Chair, that would be a standalone building type thing, not through a grant program. That's helpful. Secondly, you mentioned, and I missed, maybe you talked about it right at the beginning, I was a couple minutes late, you said you are governed or you use guidelines from the Department of Interior, is that right? They set out historic guidelines for historic buildings and sites and other things that you've incorporated and you're following, is that right?
That's correct.
Ms. Bloomberg.
Madam Chair, the guidelines that really guide all of the historic preservation work are the Secretary of the Interior standards for historic preservation.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Bloomberg, is it... do we have a statutory reference to that? How are you guided, or has your board, by rule or by policy, adopted that, and you were, by statute, the overseer? But or do we actually, in our statutes, reference the standards that our historic sites and buildings are supposed to live up to?
Ms. Bloomberg.
Madam Chair, the standards are cited in the federal laws that we are responsible for administering, and in the we have extended them in applying across the board for other projects as well, because so many of the projects end up being having some element of both, and the statutory reference is usually uses terms like appropriate historic preservation standards. We haven't use the Secretary of the Interior's name in the standards.
So lastly, now,
Representative Duncan.
Now I'll get to my parochial question. I've been summoned, I don't know if Erdahl has or not, but I've been summoned to the Wilmer Regional Treatment Center on Friday afternoon. I have no idea what for, other than that is a historic site, both the buildings and the grounds, actually, and the landscaping. It's kind of a unique property, kind of like the Fergus property, only different. But we sold part of that site off to private individuals who are remodeling and putting in new businesses and high-tech businesses, basically, out there. And they have indicated to me that they're running into some real roadblocks with the Historical Society folks on their renovation plans, and so they're going to give me a tour and explain in depth where they're having a problem with that. They basically indicated they're frustrated because I don't know who, which individual they're particularly working with, but they seem to appear they can't go anywhere beyond this individual to get satisfaction to their questions or to appeal to someone that, you know, someone has made a decision, I don't know if it's on a window or a window frame or moving a pile of dirt somewhere or something, and they say, well, this is it, this is my decision, you can't do anything else, and now I've got to go out and take the tour and come back. Where's the buck stop? Who do I get to call into my office next week and talk about this, I guess is what I'm really getting at. I'm glad you're here to answer that for me.
We'd be happy to talk with you about that. I think just a real short answer, the challenge in administering the Secretary of the Interior standards is that they're open to interpretation.
Right.
That's both the challenge and the beauty of them. And so it's a matter of finding a workable solution.
And I guess that, Madam Chair, that's the point, not only on this, but I've had it come up on other historic, you know, whose interpretation, and can we get two different interpretations from two different people out of your office, et cetera, et cetera, or with the architects, historic architects that work in the state and other things. So at times I think it can be frustrating, but I'm going to check it out, and then I'll call Kelleher there, and we'll arrange something. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a question in terms of how well we're doing in preserving our assets, and I know Mr. Kelleher has been here when we've had the higher ed systems before us, and we talked about the backlog in terms of the need for repair and so on of our colleges and universities. How are we doing with our properties that are owned and operated by the Historic Society? What
Mr.
kind of backlog
Keyes.
Do we have?
Yes.
Mr. Keyes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Carlson. This is precisely an issue that we are facing now. When we look at maintenance problems now and our ability to deal with those, of course, a maintenance problem turns into a building problem in a couple of years, and then it turns into a larger project 5 years after that. And so it's basically taking care of the small things first so they don't grow any bigger. That's one part of it. And that is really a challenge, having sufficient funds and staff to deal with 140 buildings and all the issues that come up with them. It really is a challenge. And then when those things grow into larger projects, funding for that is always, there's always more that we could be doing. We're always prioritizing, we're always shuffling them to get the ones in greatest need first. But we only can go as far as the dollars do. There is without a doubt that there could be more funding that would help us both on the maintenance side, on the rest, you know, repair part, but also as it moves up into bigger and bigger projects.
Madam Chair, without asking you to attach a number, are we falling behind or are we gaining? I happen to be a believer of protecting our assets.
Yes.
And just wanted to get a feel. I thought of that for two reasons. One, your list of requests that was up there, and the second reason, I forget what one of you testified, that at one of the sites, the deck or the porch or something had collapsed, which
right.
tells me at least in that instance we were behind somewhere, and then the slide where you showed the paint holding up the roof or something, that's another example of where apparently we were behind. So are we gaining or losing in terms of protecting those assets over time?
Mr. Keyes.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, you know, I'd say that we're holding level right now, but the water's about to right there. So, you know, it's we need help in dealing with these issues, but I don't think we're really drowning yet. I see that in the next 5 or 10 years there will be more competition from these projects repairing buildings that were built 30 and 40 years ago, essentially eating into the same budget. And the costs are constantly going up on every aspect of this, whether that's design work or staff costs or construction costs or material costs. So those figures essentially have not been adjusted for quite some time, and I think that it would merit a further conversation.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. About 3 weeks ago or so, I was listening to NPR, and I was listening about some kind of excavation in northern Minnesota that they discovered things that predate anything
known to have been found previously in Minnesota. Do you know about that? And can you tell me more? And was that true?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Bloomberg.
Representative Murphy, yes, that is true. There was an archaeological investigation that was conducted pursuant to a memorandum of agreement under Section 106 of the Historic Preservation Act, in which the archaeologists at the Leech Lake Heritage Sites Program did unearth some very early stone tools. And we are right now going through a period of a time of peer review, really trying to ascertain just how significant these are. But the kind of early indications that they are indeed very early. And there was a meeting of the Council on Minnesota Archaeology just a week ago, and so a lot of archaeologists right now are really looking into this much more closely. It's a very exciting find, certainly not something that you come across very often. So we're waiting to see what the real experts can tell us about this.
Representative
Murphy. Chair, Ms. Bloomberg, then it's earlier than anything else in North America, they said, and it's stone tools?
Correct.
Ooh. That's exciting.
Right.
Any other questions?
I hope it's not like the ruined stone.
Any other questions? If not, thank you for your presentation, and we'll be seeing you, I'm sure, this coming year.
Thank you, Madam.
Thanks so
Thank
much.
You very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
And the chair moves House File 1018 just to get that issue before us. You will note that the authorship of this is the chair, the vice chair, and the ranking minority member. It is not our bill, however. It is the Department of a finance housekeeping bill, and so if we could have Peter Sausen and Jane Rankin come forward, not only to talk about the bill, but also to answer questions. And I should tell you, members, that occasionally we think of the housekeeping bill as perhaps routine and non-controversial issues, but there are a few items in this bill that are more dramatic changes, and perhaps, Mr. Sausen, if you can call attention to the more controversial issues of the bill and help committee members understand the significance of those changes. Mr. Sausen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Peter Sausen from the Department of Finance, here to talk about House File 1018. This is an amendment to Minnesota Statute 16A.695, which was passed as part of the 1994 bonding bill. And it was passed at a time when there was a question as to how nonprofit organizations could benefit from state general obligation bonds. As I indicated in my presentation to you back in January, that this bill would be coming forward, that state bond finance property has to be publicly owned. It has to have a public program with public oversight, yet nonprofit organizations were here looking to get state general obligation bond proceeds. To help them with that, the Department of Finance asked the Dorsey Whitney Law Firm, who's our state's bond counsel, to come up with a list of guidelines that could be used and followed by the nonprofit organizations. They did that, and then the decision was made to transfer those guidelines into law, which became Minnesota Statute 16A695. And it deals with the lease of bond finance property. And the second part of the bill dealt with the sale of bond finance property. I believe it was the project that really initiated the question on the sale of bond finance property was the Wasika campus of the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota was going to sell that campus. They came to the Department of Finance and said, what do we have to do to sell this bond finance property? And we looked at each other and said, we don't know, because we're not aware that bond finance property has ever been sold. So again, we got some guidelines from the Dorsey Law Firm put into law as part of the 16A695. Now going on 13 years since that law has passed, it's something that I work with on an ongoing basis, nonprofit organizations that come to the legislature and get appropriations of bond proceeds that go to a local government and then the facility to the nonprofit. I deal with that on an ongoing basis. Right now it's confusing. This bill was written, it needs to be a better bill. There are parts of it need to be clarified, language needs to be improved. And we have a handout that we made today, and in the first part of the handout, there's a commissioner's order that, and this document that was on part of the handout, a commissioner's order that was required in the original legislation that was put into place, the commissioner of finance order, and sort of backs up the law, but it's confusing to people who are trying to deal with this to say, how does the order relate to the law? People forget to look at the order. So with the proposed legislation, the changes in this bill, the commissioner's order goes away and relevant sections of the commissioner's order become part of the law, so we don't have to deal with this other document. In addition, that there's accounting guidelines from the Department of Finance that relate particularly to the match that we're going to talk about required in projects, and we're going to get that out. This bill would take that out of the accounting guidelines and put it into the law. And there's also the grant agreements that are agreed to between the state and the local governments, and at least one provision in that is taken from the grant agreements and put into the law. We would like the local governments, when they come forward, and the nonprofits, when they come forward, to be able to read this law and understand what it says. And we'd often like to understand what it says because we become confused also. So that's the purpose of this law and the law change that we're proposing. Madam Chair, I plan to go through on with the relevant sections, if I can find my right piece of paper, the relevant sections here, if that would be okay with you, and highlight what I think are the important changes. Some of them lay out how things are done, but I'd like to talk about the relevant changes that I think are important. And Madam Chair, you mentioned controversy, and there's two things that I think that controversy is, may or may not be the right word. I've used it myself, so it's my word. But that is relates to the match and how the match is determined, which we're recommending go into the law. And the second part is the distribution of proceeds from the sale of bond finance property. We're going to be talking about that also. And those are the two points that I want to make sure that I discuss with the committee, and the committee has a chance to ask me questions on so they understand how that now works. But the bill starts out with definitions, and in line 1.12, it puts into law that when local government gets a pre-design or a design grant, which isn't bricks and mortar, it's planning for the building, that if the building is built, it becomes bond finance property, even if the building is built with other than bond proceeds. So put money into pre-design or into design, and the building is built, it becomes a bond finance building. That is unclear at this time, and it needs to be clarified so that people understand that. Moving on next to line 2.3, approved debt. I'm skipping some of the other definitions, but getting to approved debt. One of the things we've learned in doing these grant agreements with the local governments that we need to put in place just how the financing works.
Mr. Towson, so just to clarify those 1.9 to 1.14, in other words, the Asian Cultural Center just came forward and they we had their bill yesterday. If that's all we did, that $400,000, do I understand that you're saying that starts them down the path for this language binding them in the sale?
Madam Chair, that is correct. They will, if they take even $1 of bond proceeds for pre-design or design, it's a bond finance piece of property and has to conform to the requirements in 16A, 695. Back to line 2.3, approved debt. One of the things we've learned in putting together these agreements is that we need to lay out how the financing works, where the dollars from the financing come from. We need to do it, put it within the grant agreement. And we need to, one of the things we need to know is debt. If the local government is going to put debt into the project, we need to know about it. We're putting this requirement for approved debt because if the building is sold sometime in the future, debt is one of the considerations in distribution of the bond of the proceeds from the sale of the property. And in 5, 10, or 20 years, there may be a disagreement as to whether debt was put in or not. If we get approved debt and put it in the documents, it takes future disagreements away. Moving on to line 2.16, leases and management contracts. And here is where we get into the constitutional requirements of public ownership, public oversight, and public control. On line 2.19b, the lease or management contract may only be entered into for the express purpose of carrying out a government program established or authorized by law. And I need to set this up. This is a situation where you have a local government who's getting a grant of bond proceeds to build a building and plans to lease it to probably a nonprofit organization to carry out a program. The contract between the local government and the nonprofit may be only entered into for express purposes of carrying out the government program established or authorized by law. In effect, the nonprofit's carrying out a program of the local government. Line 2.24, a description of the governmental program, the statutory authority for creation and operation of the program, and the purpose of the program must be explicitly set forth in the lease or the contract. We need to have it in the lease or the contract, the purposes of the government program. Then again, there are no questions over time what the purpose of that contract is between the local government and the nonprofit. Line 2.31, a lease or management contract for a state bond finance property that includes buildings or other structures must be for a total term, including any renewals, that does not exceed 50% of the original useful life of the buildings or structures. The Constitution requires bond finance property to be publicly owned. If there's an agreement between a local government that got bond financing and a nonprofit, and the agreement is for the expected useful life of the building, let's say 40 years, legally, I believe, and in effect, the nonprofit owns the building. So we need to make sure that the contracts between the local governments and nonprofits for a term less than the full life of the building and on a policy basis, the Department of Finance has used 50% as the maximum term of the contract. So with a 40-year life of a building, the maximum contract or lease agreement can be for 20 years. We're now putting that 50% into law. We're requesting it be put into law as a means of meeting this constitutional requirement.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to go back to where you explained 2.24. And it really kind of clicked when you were talking about the 50% of the original life. It has in here the purpose carried out, established, and authorized by law. The program must be established or authorized by law. So we put together a bonding building with a contract to a nonprofit, and they get done with their program in 10 years. That building's still got 30 years of life on it. Does that building, whoever owns it or who's ever the managers of it, have to come back here to get something in law that says it's okay to put that program into that building?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, the answer to the question is yes. The legislature appropriated the money for a specific purpose, and for the local government to use it for a different purpose, they would need to come back to the legislature to get the legislature's approval.
So if they change from a fire station to a police station, they have to come back here and get our authorization to do that?
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, yes, but fire stations and police stations are usually run by a nonprofit is normally not wrong. I know, but the answer is yes. I mean, the legislature appropriates money for a fire station. Local government, you've got this money to build a fire station for the local government to make a determination that they're going to use it for a police station. It's a different use. They have to come back and get the legislative approval.
Please continue.
Thank you.
I think I was on. I was talking about the 50% life of the contract, not more than 50% of the life of the building. So we've just used the arbitrary 50% over time. We're now asking it be put into the statute. And for land, we've since a lot of buildings last 40 years, half of it is 20. For land which isn't depreciated, we're recommending that the maximum term for the lease of land be 20 years. Line 3.21, a lease or management contract must be terminable by the contracting public officer or agency if the other contracting party defaults under the lease or contract if the government program is terminated or changed. So if the nonprofit stops running the public program for the local government, the contract has to be terminated because they have stopped running the program. Or if the legislature should cancel the public program, say the local government can no longer run it, again, the lease has to be terminated to meet the requirements of the law. Line 3.6, a lease or management contract must provide for oversight of the state bond finance property and government program by the contracting public officer or agency. This is the oversight requirement of the Constitution put into the law. on an ongoing, that lays out what the local government has to do and the nonprofit have to do, but on an ongoing basis, the local government has to have oversight and control of the public program run within the public facility. And Chair, I'm now going to skip down to 4.1. A lease or management contract must require the other contracting party to take whatever actions are necessary, whatever actions in preference to the commission, whatever documents and information the commissioner determines necessary to ensure the legality and tactics and status of the state general obligation bonds. This is sort of a different thought. I've been talking about the Constitution, but the state issues general tax-exempt general obligation bonds. Tax-exempt general obligation bonds are regulated by federal tax law. Federal tax law is complicated, and this just requires the nonprofit in the examples to provide whatever information the Commissioner of Finance needs to provide to the federal government to keep the tax-exempt status of the bonds. Line 4.5, at the end of the term of a lease or management contract, or its earlier termination, the public or officer agency may take over the control of the operation. I'm not going to read the rest. I'm going to tell you what happens here. We have a building that's going to last 40 years. There's a contract between the local government and the nonprofit for 20 years. At the end of 20 years, the local government, who owns the building, has the public program responsibility for the oversight, can do one of three things. It can run the public program itself. It can contract with the original party who operated the public program to run it for another term, whatever they agree upon, or they can find another party to run the public program within the facility. But there has to be the public program, as I discussed with Representative Mahoney, there has to be that public program run in the facility over the life of the building. This clarifies what happens at the end of the first 20-year period of this lease contract. Going down to 4.19, the public officer agency is responsible for the management and operation of the state bond finance property and the operation of the governmental program, and entering into a lease or management contract does not abolish or alter this responsibility. This tells the local governments they have an ongoing responsibility for this public program. We have had situations where the local governments have come to the Department of Finance and said, we only want to be a conduit. We want to take the state's money, pass it on to the nonprofit, and we want nothing to do with this after we do that. You can't do that. The Constitution doesn't allow it. And it puts it into the law here that that is the case, that there's an ongoing responsibility of the local government. That gets us through the lease part of this. Now I'm moving on. It's line 4.28, subdivisions 3, the sale of bond finance property. And for the sale of bond finance, I'm not going to read it here, but this, for the sale of bond finance property, the local government has to determine there's no longer a need for the facility, the public program. They sell it as authorized by law, and the Commissioner of Finance approves the sale. And that's in the current law, and that is in this law, but that is how bond finance property can be sold. Then there's the distribution of the money. And this is one of the two areas I wanted to make sure people understood how it works. So there should be a handout in what we gave to you. There should be a handout that shows the distribution of money. Jane Rankin has it here. The state has a preference in when bond finance property is sold. Example 1A, and up above in Project 1, there's a $1 million building that's financed 50-50 between the state and local governments. You've got, that's where lease and sale agreements have been approved. This is a page that looks like this. And in this case, we have $1 million building, $500,000 of state money, $500,000 of local money. And sometime in the future, the building is sold for $2 million. And the way it works is the state gets paid first. In the law, the way the law currently exists, and the way that we're recommending it continue, the state gets paid first. It gets its $500,000 back. That leaves $1,500,000 left, and the remaining amounts are split by the percentage of the state and local money going in. So the state gets half of what's left, the local government gets half of what's left, the $750,000 apiece, and in total the state gets $1,250,000 and the local government gets $750,000. Why was it done this way? My recollection of why it was done this way is when the $500,000 in the example comes back to the state, it's available to make grants for additional capital projects. The money comes back to the debt service fund that provides for additional debt capacity, and would allow the state to sell additional bonds for additional projects, maybe another project for a local government. Also, the state wanted to share in the appreciation of the building. The building was $1 million when it was built and is now worth $2 million, and we put, in this case, half the money into it. We should share in the appreciation of the building. I believe those are the two reasons that this formula was put in.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With this kind of a deal, how often do people sell bond-built buildings?
Representative Mahoney, not very often. We do have another listing of just an example of a bond-financed property that has been sold. But it doesn't occur very often, and when it occurs, there's not a lot of dollars involved.
Yeah, because this, if you were to follow, Madam Chair, if you were to follow this particular process, I mean, certainly the local government would get their share of the original dollars back, but there's not a whole lot of incentive after that. Because the state, just comes in and says right off the top, I'm taking the bigger cut than you. And
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I agree with that. First of all, I'd say in most cases where I work with the local governments, they have no thoughts that they're ever going to sell the building. It's their opinion they're going to be there forever, so it's not really an issue with them. But it does happen. I had someone call me not too long ago, said they're going to sell some bond finance property and wanted to take the proceeds to use for their buy something else in their program. And I said, well, the state gets paid first. That's the law. And they said, well, there's no reason we should sell this, what we have, because there's no incentive for us to do it. So you are absolutely right on the incentive side of it.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
So you wouldn't happen to have how often that's happened other than just, off the top of your head incidental information about it. I mean, because that really doesn't sound like it's fair to a local government to, it encourages them to not recycle this land or building back into the economy.
Mr. Salson?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't have I can't tell you how many times. If you look at, I'm looking at the list here. You've got this list. I don't remember all of it. Well, the city of Truman, let's take the city of Truman, bottom of the list. They bought some lots. They're going to use it for the neighborhood land trust, and they couldn't get anybody interested. They wanted to get rid of the land because the city was managing it. They were very willing to sell it, and they were very willing to give the money back to the state. Ramsey County, North St. Paul Library, an unfortunate situation is that the bond financing in there was made for improvements for accessibility. The improvements weren't the problem. It was just a small amount of money. I think like $20,000. It shouldn't have been done as bond financing. It should have been done with general fund money. But because there was $20,000 of bond finance money in there, Ramsey County had to get our approval, and they had to pay us the $20,000 back. The balance of the building, whatever they sold it for, went to the county. The Department of Natural Resources property along the River Trail. They bought property for the River Trail and other trails that aren't shown here. And there's this little slivers of land that they don't need, and the adjacent property owners want to buy the land. They'll sell it to the property owners, and in this case, it's a state agency, but it comes back, I think, to DNR. I think they get credit for it. But in this case, it doesn't. It's not, the money isn't an issue. East Central School District and Asco Minnesota School. They were very anxious to get rid of the school building and work with me to make sure it got done right, and returning the amount of money to the state never seemed to be a consideration for it. So,
well, Madam Chair, and I don't really need a question, I don't need an answer to this, it's just, what I was trying to say is that it would be interesting if we could ever figure out how many schools weren't sold. How many land trust pieces of property weren't given back because the state kind of says, I get mine, and I get mine even bigger than you get yours. And that's all I was wondering about.
Okay. Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On example one, if the the building was built on city-owned property and now it was sold, land and real estate were sold, would you then have to appraise and separate out the land which the city owns, so they should realize the profit on the and the appreciation on the land value since they originally owned it.
Madam Chair and Representative Junkie, yes.
Okay. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. First of all, what's the intent on this in terms of when it takes effect? Are you proposing that this is going forward on future bonding, or is it retroactive?
Madam Chair and Representative Lanning, it's for sure going forward. And I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think we can do anything with this law that impairs current contracts. So if current contracts between local governments and nonprofits are currently in place, they could not be affected by this law.
Representative Lanning.
Oh, thank you. So I was going to say, if there's some retroactivity here, I think we've got to put a lot of people on notice that we're considering a significant change in the way we put this together. Now, as I understand it, historically, when the state has provided funding for a project facility in a community, that the community has had the responsibility to be the safety net to make sure that the money invested by the state in that didn't go to waste, that a building wasn't allowed to deteriorate and go into disrepair, but that the local community was not obligated to operate the program that may be operated in that or was conducted in that facility. And now the way I understand this, they would be required to continue the program, so that if they contracted with someone and they weren't able to carry out the program, the city would be required to find somebody else or to do it themselves to continue operating. Am I reading this right?
And Chair and Representative Lanning, yes, you are.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a big change in policy here, folks, and this ought to be clearly understood by anybody who is coming forward requesting bonding dollars for local projects. This is a very significant change in policy.
But this is the way the law currently works. The district, the requirement that a local government continue to operate the program for the purpose that the legislator intended is the current law. That's the way we currently have operated. And the distribution of money, as I've shown here, is the way it works under current law, and there is no change. So I don't agree that this is a significant change. I think the change is that we want to make sure we're proposing a change in the law with the intention of sitting here talking so that you as legislators understand how this works in dealing with the local governments that come forward trying to find funding money.
Representative Lyman.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I worked with these as a mayor of a community, and this is a change from what we were told in a project that was funded in our community 20 years ago. And so maybe it's changed since then that I wasn't aware of it. But
Madam Chair, Representative Lyman, the 20 years is the key, because 20 years ago we didn't have any of this. Things have changed dramatically in the last 20 years, understanding how the Constitution works and how we should be making grants to local governments.
Representative Lanning, any more?
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you go and police this?
Representative Mahoney, it's a great question, and the Department of Finance does not police it.
Yeah. What jail do you get thrown in if you violate it?
The city jail. Mr.
Sumner. Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, that there's a requirement in the grant agreements that the local governments annually certify they're doing it to carry out the governmental program. Unfortunately, many local governments apparently don't know it's in the grant agreements because they don't make that certification, and there's so many of them that we just never have been able to follow through.
Mr. Selson, I'm trying to frame a question here about is there perhaps sometimes an underlying department interpretation in terms of how you work with a local project, And maybe I'll connect it to what we have in our packet. Order, amending Order of Commissioner of Finance relating to use and sale of state bond finance property. It is hereby ordered. I haven't seen anything like this before. Is this a common document where a commissioner issues an order? And what is the weight of this? How does it compare to law?
Madam Chair, for the Commissioner of Finance, I can speak for it. This is not common. It can't change the law. The Commissioner's order can't change the law. The Commissioner's order elaborates on the law, but as I indicated earlier, it's the intent with this new proposed law to abolish the Commissioner's order. It would no longer exist just because of the type of question that you're asking.
And that's what I heard you say as you introduced it, that this was in place, and if we pass the law, it would replace this. So I'm wondering, what's the nature of this order, and how much weight does it have?
Madam Chair, the nature of the order is it elaborates on the law, and how much weight does it have? It has significantly less weight than the law itself.
Mm-hmm. Representative Junkie?
Well, I was just following up. I guess I'm trying to understand, following up on Representative Lanning and Representative Mahoney, is the change here notification to the commissioner versus approval now of the commissioner? I mean, I would think that public entities, cities, counties, school districts, understand that if you use public bonding dollars, it's for a public purpose and it's public ownership. But just because they change the tenant or the use of the building, as long as it's still public ownership and public purpose, wouldn't they simply notify you versus, or is this changing it now so you have to actually approve rather than just notify?
Madam Chair, Representative, currently the Commissioner of Finance has to approve all the agreements between the local government and the nonprofit, and that will continue to be the case.
Representative Jackie?
I mean, where would you foresee you wouldn't approve a public ownership, public purpose? I guess that's what's, I think, making people nervous here is, where wouldn't you approve some?
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, when they don't understand that there is a requirement for the local government oversight, so that the local government has no interest in having the oversight, they want to be a conduit, and they don't put any provisions in the lease agreement for the public oversight that's required. That would be a situation where we would tell them that the lease agreement doesn't meet the requirements of the law or the Constitution, and they would have to revise their document.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Junkie.
So there wouldn't be a problem going from one public ownership to another. Case in point, I think Minneapolis and Hennepin County are talking about their library system right now, where ownership may change from one public entity to another.
Madam Chair, Representative.
So the system certainly would have oversight if the county took it over.
Yeah, farther back in this bill, there's a provision that allows that. It allows the transfer of bond finance property from one public entity to another public entity for a dollar. It lays out some of the requirements to do it, but it currently allows it. That's in the commissioner's order. It would be in the law and would allow that to happen.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Salson, after the exchange between you and Representative Lanning, I just want to get on the record. So there are no significant changes from the way it is currently operated?
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, no. There are no significant changes from the way we currently are doing business under the existing law.
Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Salson, so to that point then, one of the handouts we have in our packet is Department of Finance Administration Operating Policy and Procedure issued 2001, revised 2005. So what's currently in here kind of reflects what's in the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Tinglestad, I included that because it's the match requirement that's later on in the bill. That match requirement is currently in those accounting principles. They'd be taken from there and put into the law instead of in the state's accounting manual. We think it's a better place for it.
Thank you. And I don't know if we have another committee coming in, because that is the other piece of this bill, obviously, and we may have to revisit this, unless you would just like to quickly call that issue to our attention. And
the other issue is the match issue. When the legislature appropriates bond proceeds. The local government, they often require a match, let's say a one-to-one match. This lays out that what is eligible to meet the match requirements of the local government is cash or a pledge of the local government by resolution to sell general obligation bonds to meet the match. We do not allow uncollected pledges. We do not allow the local government to go to the bank to borrow money. The state is putting equity into it in the form of the grant agreement. We think the local government should also put equity in, not a loan. But the way it is written, the legislature could override this if that's their decision and say, notwithstanding this provision in 16A695, this local project can use loans, it can use uncollected pledges to meet the match requirements. So we understand that may happen. So it's sort of this match provision pretty much provides a base of which the legislature can amend it should they want to do that.
Questions of that? Representative
Johnson. So using this definition, we would have to reference this section or the law you just stated. A lot of our bills are written to be matched with non-state resources. That's very common. That could be federal dollars, that could be county dollars, that could be, but the way this is written, that would be an exception to this rule. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, no. It would just be the federal dollars. We would say the federal dollars have to be in hand. They have to be collected funds. But you could use you could do what you're currently doing, just saying federal money or non-state sources. It's not the source, it's the having cash in hand.
And in that case, Madam Chair, cash in hand, would it be an exception then to say pursuant on matching? So you don't have the cash in hand. Is that then the federal dollars you have to, you know, it's chicken or egg, you know, with state and federal dollars. You apply here, you apply at the federal government, which one comes first? They're both contingent on non-state resources. Would we, if we would pass a bill that says matched with non-state resources, which end up being federal dollars, would we have to put that language in then upon receipt, because it's not cash in hand yet?
Madam Chair, Representative, in case of federal money, if the local government has the appropriation through Congress and they have a letter saying that this money will be available, we have accepted that and would continue to accept that as being equal to cash in hand. The federal government wants to release their money when the local government makes the expenditure. We want to do the same thing. We understand that. So in your example, with the appropriation from the federal government and the letter saying that the money is available, we would accept that as being equal to cash on hand.
And you'd do the same for them then, provide a letter that your cash is in hand ready to go to.
Madam Chairman, Representative Junkie, that's correct.
Any concluding comments on the bill? Again, this comes from the Department of Finance, probably instructive for this committee because it certainly reflects philosophy of the department, and so it's important for us to hear and understand, but I think that's the point of our hearing today.
Madam Chair, I thought we'd have some good debate on the issues where we had a debate. We did. I appreciate that. We wanted to make sure that when we brought this to the legislature, we wanted to make sure that what was considered controversial got discussed, because you as legislators work with the local governments and the nonprofits, and we wanted to make sure that you understood how some of this all works, so that you may have less questions and understand what we in the Department of Finance are doing with these grant provisions.
Because it was a posted bill, I was going to offer anyone in the audience who wanted to speak for or against. I don't know if we have a committee coming in immediately after, but I would certainly provide that opportunity if people wanted to testify on the bill. Or we can... Representative Mahoney.
Were you planning on making this whole thing a little bit more understandable? Because I like to read these bills, and this one really literally gave me a supreme headache.
Especially that last
one. Yeah, especially Subdivision 14, starting at 9-4. Just a comment. You don't have to answer right now. You can catch
Everyone
up with me at my
own. Paragraph and explain
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, members of the committee, I'm working off a bill that has footnotes that were created by the Attorney General's office explaining the changes, and I would be happy to share that with you. And you can go through provision by provision and see
know, the reason that it was put, the changes were put in.
It's very confusing.
You're referencing lines 9-4 to 9-8?
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
Madam Chair,
Mr. South.
And whoever has a question. This is a provision that says that when there are requirements for approvals by the local governments, it has to be done by the legislative body. We've had situations where local governments want to dedicate it maybe to a delegated to a department head, and for the department head to make the decision. We think that these are decisions that should be made by the legislative body who are responsible for carrying out the public program.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Mahoney,
all I'm saying is that it's really, you'd have to hire a $600 an hour attorney to kind of explain that to somebody, that particular paragraph. And you know, I'm not saying you get it. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying it's really, really confusing. And for the price of an attorney, we should be able to find someone who can write in English.
Well, we thank you for presenting the bill and answering the questions today. That bill is before us, members, and if there's no further discussion, meeting is adjourned.